destinations at? Planning route. Two. Hackney Down Station. Hackney.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. In the U.S., the first case of COVID-19 was confirmed on January 21st, 2020. As a response, many states put safety restrictions on social contact to keep people from spreading the disease. With many businesses and workplaces closing, unemployment rose dramatically, and the U.S. economy had its worst quarter since the 2008 recession. Now it's early June. To get the economy rolling again, much of the country has loosened restrictions on social engagement. On June 1st, the New York Times online map showed 41 states being open, along with 8 partly open. However, in our country, the death toll from the virus continues to rise. On June 1st, the CDC reported the number of deaths to be over 104,000. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and today we will talk about what it means to be safe as public officials loosen safety restrictions. From KHOI in Ames, Iowa, I, along with Ann Kinzel, will speak with Dr. Mark Allen Derry, an infectious disease specialist from New Orleans, who reminds us that COVID-19 is a long-term crisis. In the second half of the program, from KSFR in New Mexico, Tom Trowbridge speaks with medical doctor and researcher Stuart Kaufman about new research on social distancing. Up first, Dr. Mark Allen Derry is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at Tulane University, where he also serves as director of the Tulane AIDS Education and Training Center, director of the Tulane T-Cell Clinic, and medical director of the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program. Derry has worked around the world in pandemics and epidemics. He has a master's in public health and is also an osteopath. Here he is in responding to the choices made by states to open in June.
So, I mean, these are obviously incredibly complex issues, and I think that everybody who talks about this stuff, especially those that are public officials or healthcare officials like myself, should probably state their biases up front. So I want to state my bias up front, because you could sort people into two groups of people: those that put the public's health and interest up front, or those that put the economic or capital's interest up front. So I'm a person who's going to put the public's health and the public's interest up front. And I recognize that it's very important to have an economic structure to continue to maintain, for society to engage in. But if you don't have a public, you're not going to have an economic system. So I just wanted to kind of put that bias up front. And so when I am concerned particularly about how in New Orleans and how in Louisiana we're opening up, you know, it's not as easy as just flipping a switch. You know, I usually liken it to kind of using a dimmer switch to kind of turn on a light in a room, or using a faucet just to kind of slowly turn on the water, so it maybe starts a little bit as like a drip until the water starts to come out. But there's one thing that needs to be completely understood more than anything else, is that that we are in a situation that is completely unprecedented, and we will be here for a very, very, very long time. There were 3 notable studies that I think that are relevant to talk about here. One was that happened here in Baton Rouge, which is about 90 miles west of us here in New Orleans, and then 2 studies that happened in California. And the studies all are, you know, can easily be criticized, and we'll just skip over the criticisms of the study. And they were looking for antibodies, and what essentially antibodies are proteins in your blood that show whether or not you've been infected with coronavirus. And there's a lot of problems with the antibody testing, and if you guys want to talk about that later, we can. But assuming that the tests and the studies were good, they all showed the same thing, and that was that 5% of the population was essentially had been infected with this SARS-CoV virus, the virus that causes the COVID-19. That's 5%, okay, assuming those studies to be true. So that means 95% of society is still vulnerable and susceptible to this virus. And now what we're asking people to do is go out and re-engage in the economy again. And I find that to be particularly problematic because I don't think that we've done a great job of maybe getting ready to start flatten the curve. When you look at the U.S. numbers, we definitely have hit a plateau. When you look at Louisiana, our peak is behind us. But when I look at Iowa numbers, your numbers are still going up, both in terms of the number of cases and then, of course, in terms of mortality as well. So when I look at all of that and I recognize, you know, we still have an enormous part of the population, 95% that are still vulnerable, we are a long way away from acquiring herd immunity, which is really only going to be acquired in two ways. One would be through a vaccine, and we're a long way from that, or just through natural dissemination of virus through the population, which we don't want to happen. That takes years as well. And so to ask people to reengage in society again is, I find, to be very problematic. And I'm starting to see these in states, certainly around Louisiana, and we're very concerned about that as well, because we're doing a very good job of really making sure that we're using data to open up the state. Rather than using a date to open up the state, we're being very, very careful in making sure that we're using data to open.
So when you say using data to open the state, what data is the most important for a state to collect?
One of the main problems of what we've seen here with COVID-19, and I often say I teach in public health courses, and I anticipate that, you know, when COVID-19 is going to be taught in future public health courses around the world, they're going to really look at the United States as a case study of what went wrong, right, and how to do things better for future public health students. And one of the reasons where things went wrong was we don't have centralized coordination. And one of the people that we would turn to for what you're asking there, Ms. Ann, is that we would turn to the CDC to help guide us for a situation like that would help us provide numbers. So instead, what we have is 50 states doing 50 completely different things. So I don't know what numbers. The situation is completely unprecedented. But some gut feelings of you want to make sure that you've seen the number of cases go down, let's say over like 14 days. You want to see that the mortality has been going down, or that the hospitalizations have been going down, or you want to see that the ICU beds have been, you know, X amount are available over the course of X amount of time. I mean, it's metrics like that that you would be looking at that would help guide when opening a state back up to a certain degree.
So are you suggesting, Doctor, that those nations that have a more centralized system of both personal and public health are at an advantage over the United States?
Yeah, I would say that is definitely the case.
Any particular country that you see is doing the right thing?
I mean, when you look at the Asian countries, I think that they've been doing a great job. I think New Zealand has been doing an amazing job. I mean, New Zealand was just like, and again, it's hard to compare country to country, but New Zealand just kind of shut down. Everybody stayed indoors. And I think I read yesterday that there's been, you know, no new cases now, and I think no new deaths. So that's been tremendous. But one of the things that we recognize with COVID-19 is that asymptomatic transmission or pre-symptomatic transmission occur pretty readily, and it's something that we certainly need to be very concerned about. Because if somebody's sick, hopefully they have the common sense to stay home. But it's the leading up to sickness that's
right, when you don't know.
And then
right.
It's also the folks that actually transmit virus. Dr. Redfield, the director of the CDC, stated about 3 weeks ago that of those that tested positive in the U.S., 25% of them were asymptomatic. And Iceland, who's another country, by the way, that's been doing a great job, by the way, Iceland, who has tested an enormous proportion of their population, what they have found is that they found up to 50% of those that tested positive were asymptomatic.
Wow.
So we have a range of 25 to 50% that are asymptomatic. Okay, well, that's good. That means that that folks, you know, are not getting sick as intensely as we thought initially that they might. But that still speaks to the fact that this virus is incredibly infective and can transmit very easily amongst people. So the virus will find those people that are...
Looks like there's a problem.
Sorry, my our assistant's talking to us. So what the virus does is it'll very easily transmit amongst people who are as of yet that are susceptible or vulnerable to the disease.
Mark Allen, we just have a few minutes left, but since you're talking about transmitting it, I just wanted to ask you a few questions about the virus itself. As I understand it, the problem is that it's airborne, right? That it really can be transmitted through the air.
So that's a fine hair to split here. So let me just kind of answer your question. But if you look at the CDC website, it'll still say that it's still a droplet. So droplets are essentially the spittle of your mouth, saliva as it leaves your mouth in the form of the saliva as it leaves your mouth is referred to as spittle. That's where the word spit comes from. And as the spittle leaves your mouth, the virus lives inside those droplets. Those droplets are large enough that they actually have enough of a mass that gravity is able to pull it down, usually about 3 feet within a person as that spittle leaves a person's mouth. So those are referred to as droplets. What we are starting to see is that as that droplet desiccates, dries, as it's going through the air, that there is research showing that the virus has now become aerosolized. So that means that it can travel through the air a little bit more. So airborne and aerosolization, again, that's that splitting of that fine hair. So while there's other illnesses like measles or tuberculosis that are referred to, and sometimes influenza are referred to as being airborne, right now I think it's fair to say that there is an element of aerosolization. So that means that the virus can transmit through the air a little bit more regularly than we originally thought. There was a study last week at a Tulane at the Primate Center, which they were able to show that they were able to aerosolize the virus for about 16 hours. Now, just because the virus is aerosolized for 16 hours doesn't necessarily mean that it's an infectious particle, but they were able, so we haven't seen that yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But again, we haven't quite seen that. But probably the study that actually is, I think, the most relevant was a study that happened in China. It was released like 2 weeks ago, and essentially what happened was they scanned all these people coming into the restaurant for fevers. They were all fever-free when they got in. They sat down at the restaurant. This man was pre-symptomatic, so this is before he started showing symptoms of COVID-19. And what they showed was that this person transmitted virus to 12 or 13 other diners in this restaurant, largely because of the air conditioning unit that was... he was sitting at a 90-degree angle of where he was, and so they were able to show the circuits or the air swirls that happened and how other folks then became infective as a result of that. So the big issue here and the concern is that essentially we know that a majority of the population is still susceptible to the virus, 95%, assuming those numbers to be true. We recognize that asymptomatic transmission of the virus is 25 to 50%. And then we also recognize that this virus is, you know, transmitted droplets and possibly aerosolized. And then we're asking people to go back out into society. I have a very hard time doing that. People aren't wearing masks. I mean, the face coverings and the cloth coverings over the face are incredibly effective in decreasing that mouth spittle that we were talking about, which is how the virus is transmitted. 90 to 100% of your mouth spittle is actually captured on the inside of that face covering, and we refer to that as source control. And that source control is so effective in decreasing viral transmission that if it were me, if I could wave a magic wand, I would have everybody wearing face coverings. And if we had a lot of people, or if we had the entire country wearing face coverings, the number of cases would go down pretty rapidly. So until that happens, people are still susceptible to virus as they walk around out of society.
Okay. Well, thank you. We've run out of time, but thank you so much, Mark Allen, Dr. Mark Allen Derry, for joining us and speaking of face masks. I saw my first baby with a face mask on. On Saturday. So it was cute, but a little bit weird. But I don't know what the baby thought of that. But anyway, thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had a whole other hour just to kind of unpack this with you. But sure. Really appreciate the information. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. Today we're hearing from two doctors speaking about what it means to be safe as most states loosen social restrictions during the COVID-19 pandemic. In the first half, we heard from Dr. Mark Allen Derry speaking to KHOI Radio in Ames, Iowa. And next we will hear from Tom Trowbridge in KSFR in New Mexico. He spoke with Dr. Stuart Kaufman about new research on social distancing.
I'm with Dr. Stuart Allen Kaufman. And Dr. Kaufman, first of all, tell us about yourself, your personal history, as well as your professional history.
Well, thank you. I grew up in Sacramento, California. I went to Dartmouth, went on a Marshall Scholarship to Oxford. I was going to be a philosopher, decided I wasn't smart enough, and besides, I didn't want to just do conceptual analyses. So I went to medical school at the University of California in San Francisco, got my medical degree in 1968, both practicing in emergency rooms, but doing mathematical work in biology. So I worked in a number of areas in science, in biology, on cancer, on the origin of life. I had the founding patent with my friend Marc Balibe, filed in 1985. On what became a multi-billion-dollar industry. I actually made the first library of random DNA molecules with Marc Balibe in 85. I worked on areas in quantum mechanics and other areas.
Stuart, you've produced a short documentary titled COVID-19, A Challenge for Civilization, and it presents two major ideas. Could you expand on that for us, please?
Here we are in the midst of COVID-19. We understand something of its dangers. We all know that we're doing social distancing. We need to know actually three things. Social distancing works, but the first of the two essential ideas that people don't know is that it only works above a threshold of about 80% social distancing. This is based on the work of Mikhail Prokopenko at the University of Sydney, who modeled Australia, and he found that if social distancing is 0%, 10, 20, 30, up to 70%, essentially, it does no good whatsoever. At 80%, it does a lot of good, and it may do a bit more good at 90%. So there's a threshold, and the critical implication is we better be above that threshold for it to do any good. So that's idea one. Idea two is being below the threshold, so 20% or 30% social distancing, means that the disease will grow exponentially fast. So to remind ourselves of what an exponential is, when you put money in the bank and you get, say, 3% a year, every year it goes up by 3%. In the case of COVID-19, in the early days in China, roughly every day the number of infected people went up by 15% every day. In Italy, early on, the number of infected went up by 25% every day. If it goes up 25% every day, it explodes exponentially. Were that to happen in the U.S., we would lose about 2.2 million. Globally, we would lose about 50 million, which, you know, scales with the World War II, where 40 million people died. The essential next piece is really due to my friend Gabor Vaté, who published an analysis of the data in China and Italy. If you're above the threshold, instead of the disease continuing to explode at, say, 20% a day, the rate of growth slows from 20% to 15% to 10% to 5% to zero. The disease stops spreading. Mathematically, that's called logistic. It just means that the growth goes up and then it levels out. The astonishing thing, Tom, is people don't seem to know there's this threshold that sound, and they don't know it's this transition, mathematically it's a phase transition, from exponential growth to logistic growth. And this means something practical. I want to get to why it matters now, here and anywhere in the world. We can monitor right now in Santa Fe, or in Hobbs, or in Milwaukee, or on the steppes of Russia, or in Paris, anywhere. We can monitor if the growth of the disease, say in Santa Fe, is going up exponentially. Here's how. We take the hospitals in Santa Fe, and we take and just look at the number of new COVID-19 patients each day, or say each week. If it's going up 10% a week, week after week, it's going up exponentially. If it's going up 5% week after week, it's going up exponentially. That means something now in Santa Fe. It means increased social distancing dramatically now. Otherwise, people will die. If instead in Santa Fe or Hobbs, in the area around Hobbs, the disease is originally going up at 15% a day, then slowing to 10% a day, then to 5% a day, then zero, then we're in this logistic regime, and vastly fewer people will die. So we have something to act on, Tom, and I'm quite confident of the science. You should always be skeptical and careful in using it. But the idea, just the concept of monitoring in any local region, Shanghai, the backcountry of China, anywhere, is right now is the rate of growth of the disease slowing from, say, 20% to 15%, to 10% to 5% to zero. Monitoring it that way harms no one. The data are available. Let's just use it. Part of what's driving me crazy, Tom, is that I can't get these ideas out in the United States. Let me define 80% social distancing. It means for 100% of the people, they're spending 80% of their waking time at home, fundamentally, isolated from one another, 6 feet apart, in their homes, not going shopping more than maybe once a week. We've been told how to isolate it. It's really quite sensible. But, Tom, part of the worry is, as far as I could tell, it's highly variable right now in the United States. It's highly variable in Africa, in South America. People don't know there's this threshold. It seems sensible that if you do a little bit, it would help. But Prokopenko's results say no. 30% social isolation really doesn't help. It just takes people out of the labor force.
Stuart, when you hear the calls by some to back off of New Mexico's stay-at-home order and those who are demanding businesses reopen, even at with a social distance parameter, for the sake of the state and national economy, what do you think of that?
I think the same thing Governor Cuomo does. Suppose that we were suddenly to stop social distancing when COVID-19 is at its height. It would explode again. So that means that... let me roughly say it the following way. Suppose that we socially distance enough so the rate of growth of the disease has gone from 15% a day or a week to 1% or 2%, and then we gently and gradually open up. Governor, is it Newsom in California?
Gavin Newsom.
Yeah, he's wonderful. Has sensible ideas like opening up, and have restaurants with fewer tables than them further apart, and your waiter has a mask on, gloves on. If we think about it and do it carefully and gradually, if we're lucky, what will happen is we will get little flaring outbursts locally, and then we can try, as everybody knows, this is not me, we track those as they did in South Korea, and track and isolate. We're going to have, just think medically, it's a year and a half to a vaccine. In order to have, we all know what herd immunity is. It's that enough people are immune that the disease doesn't spread in the community. For most diseases, for measles, 95% of the people have to be immune for it to not spread. For COVID-19, nobody knows, but for many viruses, 80% of the people have to be immune. Well, that means we have to wait till we have a vaccine and immunize a very large number of people so that 80% are fraction will have gotten the disease and now be immune, and that helps a bit, but probably not that much. So we have to wait for a vaccine. Between now and then, Tom, we're not talking much about efforts to make antivirals that can act in the meantime to help people who are gasping for death on the ventilators that our president doesn't take responsibility for not supplying. So there are actions that people don't in general know about to find antivirals, and there's hopes, a few fairly well known, but there's procedures called phage display and monoclonal antibodies and siRNA, and the possibility of screening already approved FDA drugs to find useful ones. So that could work. Actually, I'm trying to get some friends to do that. A colleague of mine and I did it for another purpose and found 1% of we screened 1,500 drugs to do something strange, making one cell type differentiate to another cell type, and we found 16 that did it. That's a 1% success rate. Well, there's about 2,000 FDA-approved drugs. If we were lucky and we screened 2,000 FDA drugs and had a 1% success rate, we might get 20 potential antivirals fast. They would be FDA-approved, they could maybe get into the field fast, which would be wonderful. So those things are going on. Certainly monoclonals are going on around the world. I can explain what...
I was going to say, what are monoclonals?
Monoclonals. It's a lovely idea. Somebody got the Nobel Prize for it in the 70s. When COVID-19 infects a person, that person makes antibodies that bind COVID-19 and block its action. The cells that do that in a person are called B cells, and they're lymphocytic cells. So each B cell makes a specific antibody molecule. In the 1970s, I should remember the man's name, found a way to take a single B cell and, quote, immortalize it, so it just grows and grows and grows and makes hundreds of billions of the same makes 100 billion cells, and they all make exactly the same antibody molecule. So that's called a monoclonal, that's one clone of B cells, antibody. Since the 1970s, medical scientists and doctors have been using monoclonals to treat all kinds of things, including kinds of cancer, you should know. So monoclonals have been used to treat Ebola, and they work. People are now starting up around the world trying to make monoclonals that will block COVID-19. So that can happen. It will have to go through clinical trials. It will probably work on a time scale of several months.
Dr. Kaufman, anything else you'd like my listeners to know about your research on COVID-19?
Take it absolutely seriously. Stay socially distanced. It's not a toy. It's not fake news. It's not a democratic fraud. It's a killer.
Stuart Alan Kaufman is a distinguished physician from Santa Fe. Dr. Kaufman, thanks so much for your time on KSFR today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Reopening the Country, What It Takes to Be Safe. Our contributors this week were myself, Ursula Rudenberg, and Ann Kinzel from KHOI Radio in Ames, Iowa, and Tom Tobridge from KSFR in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thanks to featured guests Dr. Mark Allen Derry and Dr. Stuart Kaufman. Editing assistance came from Stephanie Schubert. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced globally in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase globally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, again, that's me, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Sprouts.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Disability Justice, an Everyday Pursuit and Survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
On the phone today is Lucy Balthazar.
Hello.
Can you tell us about your bio?
Okay, so hello, my name is Lucy Fengxian Yuan Balthazar. I was adopted from Guangxi, China, Nanning City at the age of 20 months by my adoptive parents. I grew up in Denver, Colorado. I was exposed to my Chinese heritage in different ways. My parents took me to Chinese language school and we went to a Chinese language school and we went to a Chinese heritage camp up in the Rockies, up in the Rocky Mountains of Denver, Colorado, and we went to the one in town in Denver. And so my mom and my adoptive parents, they wanted me and my sister to be exposed to our Chinese culture. Yeah.
And when did you move to Portland?
I moved to Portland in the summer of 2006.
And when did you start attending Think College?
I attended Think College the year I was in my second year of the CTP program in 2016 to 2017.
So, Lucy, can you tell us about Think College?
So, Think College is a four-year program at Portland State University, and it's funded by the Department of Ed and its partnership with the College of Ed, and it gives people, young adults, who experience intellectual disabilities a pathway to go to college and experiences like just like any other college student, to go to college and get a certificate when it's over and get jobs and get into being included in the campus community.
Lucy, has the name changed from Think College to something else?
Yes, it has. Career and Community Studies.
So, Lucy, can you tell me how you get into Think College?
You have to write a personal statement why you want to go to college, and you have to get letters of recommendation, and you have to have a documented disability. Like a document. And you have to have prior work experience or volunteer experience. And you have to write a personal statement why you want to go to college and what your plan for finishing college would be. And you have PCP meetings to help you with it.
What are PCP meetings?
It's a person-centered plan meeting that you meet with your team, and they help you plan your 4 years of college. They have to plan.
And who are these people who do this? I mean, is that your case manager or PA?
No, it's the people in the program, the people who support all of us in the program. They support us at our PCP meetings, and they are the facilitator in the meeting, so they facilitate.
Can you tell me what help you got going through college?
The help I got support from my academic coach, and I got support from the CCS staff in the program, and they supported me and the other students with our advising meetings, and they supported us in the seminars.
What is an academic coach?
An academic coach is a student. Most of them are becoming they want to become a special ed teacher or a elementary inclusive teacher, and they are going to school to become a STED teacher, high school special ed teacher, or an elementary inclusive education teacher.
Is there some kind of staff supervision of these student teachers or student helpers?
They have a coaching. We have a coaching log, and they track and they share that with the people, and then they monitor our progress to make sure we're doing the job.
And how often do you meet with the people who are monitoring your progress?
Once a month. once a week. We have coaching for 1 hour each week, and we have advising 1 hour each week.
So, Lucy, what was the courses required for your education?
The courses, I was supposed to take a freshman inquiry class of my first year of college, and I took the CCS, the seminar was 2 credit class, and then on top of that was coaching and then advising. And all of those were required to pass the course. If you didn't pass your course, you wouldn't pass the class.
And what was the funnest class to take?
The funnest class I took was immigration, migration, and belonging.
And what about the hardest class?
Theories of crime and justice. We talk about like crimes and why people commit crimes and why they do what they do.
Can you tell me about the grading for this system? How does it work? Is it pass-fail or do they give you a...
How we took it, it was complicated. When I was in the program, they said we can take speech and audit courses, but they changed it. If you wanted to get credit, students had the option to take classes for the credit, or they can take pass and no pass, but now they give us the option to take it for a credit.
So, Lucy, were there any group projects that you had to do for class?
One group project is we had to make a video and do some research from this book named Ceremony by Leslie Momosico, and we had to get quotes and stuff from the book, and we had to make... Each group had to do a creative project that related to the book.
And were you the only one in this group project with an intellectual disability?
I was the only person in that group with a disability, but my other friend, Navaya, he also had a learning disability too, and intellectual disability. So we were the only CCS students in the first year of the program who took that class.
And did it make you feel alienating to have a disability and nobody else had the same disability or could relate to your difficulties in taking the class?
No, because I always thought my life had been me growing up, and I always know that I had a disability. Ever since I was born, my mom and my dad could tell I had a disability, and I knew that. It wasn't a surprise, but I just knew I had to like work a little bit. I needed help with some stuff, and other people don't need as much help as me, but yeah. So, I noticed I had a disability, but that didn't let me down. But I still did everything I could do, but I did it differently than my peers did it.
So you just kept on doing the best you could.
Yeah, but I think got extra help. Yeah, that's...
You know, definitely other people are going to follow along in your footsteps, and they probably are going to feel a little nervous about being in classes with people who don't experience an intellectual disability. And I was kind of curious, was there any help? I mean, like if you were experiencing some problems around there, was there any help to help you out either during the class or after the class with any of these difficulties that you might have had?
So I was registered with the Disability Resource Center. And then they gave us commendations. They gave me a note taker, like for people to take notes for me. And they, when I was registered, before I went into the program, we had a meeting, and we learned about the different software that people can use who have disabilities. And I'm still registered with the DRC. I had to get some proof of my documented disability and my IEP and all that stuff.
So this is something that somebody else doesn't feel like I'm doing this and I'm just doing this all alone and there's no help or anything else like that. It does sound like there is somebody there to give you some assistance when you need it.
Yeah.
So, Lucy, with the pandemic, It's been made quite aware that, you know, people are doing things online. How has this affected you? How have you had to complete your courses?
I just do mine all on Zoom. That's where I have almost all my classes all on Zoom.
So does that mean you've become quite skilled with Zoom then?
Yes, I taught myself how to use Zoom.
Oh, really? You taught yourself how to use Zoom?
Yeah, so the person from the program, he sent us tutorial videos how to work Zoom, and I taught myself how to do it.
Wow. Considering I have huge problems with Zoom, I really appreciate the help. So, Lucy, can you tell us what your graduation is going to look like with this pandemic?
They want to have it all on Zoom. There's going to be a ceremony for the 500 students in my cohort on June 14th, I posted it on the Activities with Everyone page on Facebook. So that's going to be at 10 o'clock on June 14th. And then there's another ceremony with all the students at CSU. So that's going to be at 11 a.m.
Do you feel like, I'm just kind of curious if you feel like, I mean, I assume you were looking forward to walking down a stage and...
Yeah, see, I wanted to walk across that stage and get my diploma. That's what I wanted to do, walk across that stage. And
now that you have to do it with, did you say Zoom? And I heard something else, but I couldn't remember what it was. And you posted it on Facebook. So does that mean when you say you posted it on Facebook, it's open to anybody who wants to?
Yeah, anybody who wants to come.
Okay. So I know I'm going to do my best to be there. We look forward to seeing your graduation. I wish we could be there in person and watch you walk across the stage and get your diploma and all that other great stuff. So, Lucy, can you tell us about the grant that's funding Think College?
Yeah, so we got a grant from the Department of Ed and the College of Ed, and then the grant was for 4 years, and now it's 2020, and the grant will... And now they're trying to fund other ways, like through different school districts, to help fund the grant after this is over.
And And I'm just kind of curious. Obviously, this program adds a lot to people with intellectual disabilities. And with the pandemic and the financial crisis and everything else like this, would you say this is definitely one of the programs that needs to be funded?
Yeah.
And do you have any idea what it would mean if it wasn't funded?
People won't get the certificate and they won't be able to graduate if we don't have this program.
Hey, Lucy, I was wondering, do you have any stories about being a student?
Yes, I have stories about my former academic coaches.
Would you mind telling us?
Yes.
Go for it.
So I remember meeting my first academic coach. Her name was Lily Kwong and stuff. And I remember the lady who was the director of the program back then. She said, and then her name was Sue. And she said, Lucy, go to Lily. And that's how we were paired up. And we worked very well with each other. And we had the similar life experiences. We both experienced similar life experiences when we were younger and back in our past and stuff, but now we're very good friends and we call each other every night now. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we do stuff together.
So your mentor has become one of your best friends?
Yeah, she was my first academic coach.
And do you think you'll keep a contact with her for throughout the rest of your life and, you know, do things with her? Oh, okay.
Yep. We have plans. Mm-hmm. We have plans. We're going to go to Seattle this summer for the day. Go up to Seattle for the day and come back.
So this, going through Think College has enabled you to get a long-term relationship with a mentor who could potentially have a positive influence on you throughout the rest of your life?
Yes. She's not a mentor. She's a academic coach.
Academic coach.
Yeah.
And it sounds like she's graduating from academic coach to really good friend.
She graduated in 2017. When I graduated from CTP, she graduated college the year I graduated from the transition program.
So, Lucy, is it true that people on Think College have to have jobs?
It's a choice. I think for most students, they want a job so they can support themselves and they can make money in college while they are working in college.
Where did you have to get this job?
I got it. I worked at the TriCare Center. I worked at Helen Gordon, and I got that job through Voc Rehab in the Portland State, and they are supporting me now to get an off-campus job, for a long-term job.
So the state, so is it the campus that's supporting you to get a long-term job, or is it Voc Rehab that's...
That's Voc Rehab in Trellis. The job developer named Trellis right now, because I will be working at Helen Gordon after I graduate. So that's the plan, is for me to get a new job after college.
What is Helen Gordon?
It's a child care center. They have infants to preschool age children, and it's open to the PSU community and PSU students who have children. And it's a child care partner with the College of Education.
And what is your job with the child care service?
I worked there since freshman year, so I worked in different classrooms, supervised nap time. I have with meal time. I worked in the kitchen. I have to get breakfast and lunch. And I just supervise, interact with the families and the children, I had to assist with diapers and toileting and cleaning up and tidying up, and I have a food handler's card. It was supervision, and I had to go to meetings and stuff. Yep.
And so you just interact with the children, you don't interact with the parents at all?
Sometimes when I drop off the kids, sometimes we say hello, welcome, sometimes we say hello to the families and we say welcome. Just we interact with the children and families too when they come into the center. We greet them in a friendly manner. We say hello, good morning,
So, Lucy, what are your future plans after you get your certificate?
So my future plans after I graduate and get my certificate is get a job maybe as a paralegal professional working in a school district with high school, and as a paralegal professional with one of my former academic coaches I already mentioned, work with in her class, and maybe if she doesn't lose a job, and then travel, and then just do the things I enjoy doing now, but have more time for activities, such as working with the provider and doing group stuff with my store and other stuff.
Yes, let's hope that the state doesn't cut our services.
I hope not.
So, Lucy, what advice would you give to new students going through the Career and Community Studies program?
I think just enjoy it and take advantage of everything there is to do. Take advantage of all the activities.
So what activities did you do in college that had nothing to do with classes?
So I did that. I joined the Latin Dance Club my sophomore year of college. I took a salsa dance class in college. So I danced bachata, cumbia, merengue, and salsa. I did that, and I did the unified sport at Portland State, and I was the co-president and the safety officer I was the co-president and safety officer my junior and senior year of college. So I had to attend the budget meetings and help write the budget.
So it looks like your certificate took about 4 years to achieve.
Yep.
That's a long time to dedicate to education.
We want to congratulate you. Let's give her a round of applause, everybody.
Congratulations, Lucy.
Thank you, John.
We will see you there at your graduation through Zoom.
Both me and Dina.
And Bob.
And Bob.
The dog. Bob the dog. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks again, Lucy, for helping us out with this. It's been really valuable for us to learn about Think, and I'm pretty certain it will be quite valuable to anybody else who's listening to the program who would be interested in furthering their education and knowing that they wouldn't be alone in, you know, pursuing that.
Who should they contact?
They should contact Sue Bird or maybe Morningstar. They are like the co-directors of the program.
Morningstar, did you say?
Yeah, maybe Morningstar and Sue Bird.
And they're with what department?
They work for the CCS program, but they are also professors themselves. They are also professors in the College of Ed.
Oh, College of Ed. Okay, at Portland State University.
Thank you very much for being on the program today. We hope to talk to you again sometime in the future.
Okay, you too, John.
Yeah, it's always good to see you, Lucy. I hope to see you in person real soon, you know?
Yes.
During this pandemic, there are still ways of educating yourself and connecting with others. You can go to your, or you can access your city library through the web and the ARC of Multnomah and Clackamas County.
Yeah, city libraries have a lot of virtual classes, and the ARC of Multnomah County, DJ Lamar has a virtual dance. Club Impact has information there of how to do some social things online. There's a music and movement and mindfulness class. And if you go to the ARC of Multnomah County, Clackamas County's website, you can connect through them through an email blast to get connected to those activities.
And we'd also like to say that Public Annex is still doing its art classes, but they are now doing them on Zoom.
You can contact Public Annex through publicannex.org website. And those classes are Wednesdays at 11, but you need to get on their website and get your email connected to them so they can send you the Zoom address.
I'd like to remind everybody that we have a self-advocate taking action meeting on June 12th from 11 to 1. It's a Zoom meeting, so nobody needs to be in person. And it will be a two-parter. We will be dealing first off with how we are dealing with the pandemic, and the second part will be
the budget cuts and how we can advocate around it. And we'll talk about how to develop your own testimony and how to find your legislators to do that. We're also working on a project to help people record their own testimonies to present. And we'll be doing that after the meeting, but we can get your information if you want some help around that.
Also, SATA is, or Self-Advocates Taking Action, also called SATA, is partnered with Build a Movement and Speak Up, Speak Out.
You can find Self-Advocates Taking Action on Facebook. If you just plug those words in, you will find us, and that's where you can get the Zoom address for our upcoming advocacy events.
Speaking about budget cuts. We are really needing some advocacy around budget cuts concerning the IDD community and disabled community. Please, if you know your legislators, please speak to them on behalf of us about budget cuts. Also, if you happen to know any out-of-state legislators, please speak to them about budget cuts.
Yeah, the out-of-state folks, that part's important in the fact that revenue has been lost by states, and that is impacting a lot of government agencies like developmental disability agencies, DHS. And so these federal, there are possibly going to be a federal stimulus package for the states. And if you can ask other state legislators, like if you have relatives or friends in other states that can contact their personal senator to encourage them to pass state stimulus money, because that is going to help all of us not have such a big cut that we're anticipating with the state programs.
Thank you.
If you're wanting to look up your Oregon state legislator, you can just Google how to find your Oregon state representative or legislator lookup Oregon state, and then it'll bring you right to a page where you can enter your zip code. Hopefully that can help you and you can begin your process of talking to your own personal legislator about
and advocate for the issues that are important. That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kbu.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
Thank you. O Portland.
I'm Wendy Ring.
I'm Brian Curtis, and this is Cool Solutions with stories of climate action from the bottom up.
In this episode, we're talking about blue carbon. And by that, we don't mean a sad song about the state of the planet.